Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we talk with Chef Grant Achatz. He and his Alinea restaurant in Chicago have racked up every best award out there. His food is what I think of as culinary science fiction, yet it's stunningly intimate and delicious. We talk inspirations and holidays of long ago and now. Well, Sally Schneider, that slick streamliner of all good things, has a how-to for a lush homemade gift, your own homemade chocolates. Cocktail expert Dale DeGroff brings us up to date on the great cocktail renaissance. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, with all your travels, what puts you in the holiday spirit?
When I think of dining out for the holidays, I think of a really comfortable, friendly, old-fashioned inn. Mm-hmm. And we've got a couple to talk about today. One is the Silvermine Tavern, which is not far from where we live in Connecticut. It's in New Canaan, Connecticut. It's been around since, well, actually the buildings have been around for several hundred years, but it's been a tavern since the 1920s. And it's most famous year-round for its brunch. And the brunch in particular is extremely famous for these wonderful little sticky buns, of which you can eat like maybe a
dozen.
I think
they call them honey buns.
Honey buns, whatever.
To be accurate.
Okay. But you could just eat a dozen of these, which would be a shame because then you wouldn't be able to avail yourself of the corned beef hash, the sausage, the bacon, the cream chicken, the potato pancakes, the macaroni and cheese, the vegetable lasagna, the blintzes, the smoked salmon, et cetera, et cetera.
But it's really this great 80-year-old place. I mean, it's... Oh my gosh, it's kind of creaky and everything.
Does it have fireplaces and that kind of stuff?
Yes, and the floors are all, strange angles. Yeah. And it looks out over this beautiful pond. And it's just lovely. And Christmas, of course, is without a doubt the best time to go there.
They have a Christmas, they're actually not open on Christmas Day, but they have a Christmas Eve buffet that is really just grand.
Well, that sounds like a great way to spend Christmas Eve.
It is decorated to the hilt, and the food it's really good old kind of Yankee cooking, nothing too fancy, but really hearty and good and homey. And one of the interesting things about the Silvermine Tavern is that it's in a part of town called Silvermine, named because back in the 17th century, the people who settled there thought they would be finding great loads of silver.
Surprise!
They did not. Yes.
Surprise!
They did not.
No silver in New England.
No, but it's still a treasure.
It also sounds like one of those menus that's an equal opportunity ethnic menu. I love the idea of the blintzes as good old New England fare.
Exactly. Yankee blintzes. Yes, one of my favorite dishes.
So where else?
Actually, we've got the best connection here because the other place we're going to recommend is in Dahlonega, Georgia, which in 1828 had a faux gold rush of its own. And in fact, they thought they were going to find...
There's a theme here.
Yes, exactly.
There's a big theme.
A very hopeful theme considering what's going on.
Dashed hopes at Christmas.
Yes.
No, not... Actually, they did find some gold, but it wasn't what they had hoped. However, at the time, a guy named Captain Hall built a house there. But then it was named for its subsequent owners, Henry and Bessie Smith. Captain Smith, I think it was... which has now become one of the great classic Southern boarding house style meals.
Right. Long tables where everybody sits together.
Everything's family style. So, you serve yourself from big bowls and dishes.
And it's, the Smith House was built before the Civil War. And like the Silvermine Tavern, is creaky and the floors are crooked, but it's... even if you've never been to either of these places, as soon as you walk through the door, you feel your home. Now, not in your own home, but in
home. How lovely.
Yeah, and quite frankly, either of those places are much more charming than my home. So I like going there.
Well, what
kind of food? I mean, is this typical Southern, you know?
Yes.
I do have to tell you, they do not have blintzes on the menu at the Smith House in Dahlonega, Georgia. Okay. No, it's pretty it's like great fried chicken, Brunswick stew, baked ham.
Crackling cornbread.
Yeah, just a great, you know, deep South, hearty, homey menu. One of the great things there that which I don't think of as typically Southern is the roast beef. It's like pot roast, you know, that kind of big hunks that just fall apart if you look at them hard.
Oh, this
just don't look
fabulous.
For gold or silver at either of these places. That you won't find any.
No, I mean, look, you don't need gold or silver when you've got that kind of food. Hey, happy holidays, guys.
Thank you, Lynn. You too.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Silver and gold. Silver and gold. Everyone wishes for silver and gold. How do you measure its worth? Just by the pleasure it gives here on earth. Silver and gold, silver and gold.
Gina Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. So you're thinking all those people that you want to gift and all those dollar signs racking up. Well, consider doing something a little different this year. Give the gift that no one expects, the weird and delicious food gift. Now, I am talking nothing much over $6 or $7 and a lot of things that cost half that. Here's the idea. Give cooks and non-cooks things they haven't tried yet, and include ideas for how to use them. A little tamarind concentrate, for instance, can turn a rookie loose in the kitchen. Last year, our producer Sally Swift and I cracked each other up when she gave me Middle Eastern pomegranate syrup and I gave her Middle Eastern date vinegar. Our friends had pomegranate and date barbecue all summer. But forget the gourmet shops. For bargains, go to the sources. Shop the ethnic markets. Wander the aisles and pick up whatever looks interesting, from rosebud tea for icy nights to maybe a special soy sauce for takeout sushi. Wrap up gifts in foreign language newspapers. They're often free right at the shop door. Check out our podcasts about holiday reveling on the website, splendidtable.org. And, oh, while you're there, be sure to check out all the other examples of vital, essential, life-changing information. Our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, recipes and information on our book, How to Eat Supper. You can find them all, you know where, splendidtable.org. The way cookbook author Sally Schneider thinks about food. She takes a basic recipe or a rule and then she riffs on it. And in the process, she gives us permission to experiment and to trust our instincts. Sally's the author of The Improvisational Cook. Sally, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to be here.
So, Sally, I'm thinking homemade holiday gifts. What thoughts have you on that subject?
Well, actually, I was in a much-touted chocolate maker the other day, and I saw these incredible-looking slabs of chocolate embedded with various combinations of nuts and seeds and herbs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, I bet I could do that, perhaps a little grandiosely, because you have to respect a couple of rules with chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, Lynn, this is the easiest chocolate over-the-top gift you can make for someone at half the price of buying it, if you follow a few little guidelines.
So what are the guidelines?
First of all, use really good chocolate, because you want to still have all those perfumes and flavors as the artisanal chocolate maker. So I buy Valrhona or Scharfenberg or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy it on the internet in bulk much more cheaply. It's still a bargain. And you'll know that you're getting fresh chocolate, which is essential. It's essential to the chemistry, because if you use chocolate that, say, has a bloom over it or may have sat on your shelf for
a few months,
like
a white haze on it?
Exactly. Yeah. The structure of the chocolate's cocoa butter crystals can change. Now, that's very complicated, and we don't need to get into it. You just need to follow this method. That is, you chop the chocolate, right, your fresh chocolate, into maybe, you know, less than one-inch pieces. You can do it in a food processor. Then you melt half of it very slowly over a low flame. I use a very heavy pot set on a flame tamer. You can use a double boiler, putting the chocolate over, not in, the bowl over, not in the water.
Right.
But at all costs, you cannot get any water in the chocolate or it will seize up.
Which or is any why steam. Any steam.
No
too.
Steam. Right. So if you're using the double boiler method, you have to be really careful. You stir the chocolate frequently, and it will melt in a few minutes. You take it off the heat, and then you add the second half of your chopped chocolate, and you stir that in. And it's the second half that is essential. It cools down the melted chocolate, and it's adding in some properly tempered chocolate, which is what we want to make it set properly, into the mix. Then I lay a sheet of wax paper on the countertop or in a sheet pan, pour the chocolate on, smooth it out to about 1/8 of an inch thick, really thin. And that's your palette for improvising with all kinds of nuts. For example, the other day I threw Marcona almonds, which are those toasted Spanish almonds.
Oh, yeah, they're with very little, crunchy, very crunchy.
And they have a fabulous flavor with a little bit of sea salt right on top so that that would hit your mouth. You can add dustings of flavorings. I thought with dark chocolate, why don't I try a little curry powder? So I sifted some over the top, again with sea salt to kind of balance the flavors. It was quite smashing. all kinds of things. Dried fruits, dried cherries are my favorite with dark chocolate, and I threw on a little bit of lavender and black pepper. Think crystallized ginger. Think bits of nougat, taroni, chopped caramels, maybe with some salted peanuts. Nuts should always be toasted. It's very important.
Right.
You can also just fold all this stuff into the chocolate and then pour it out into your sheet pan. But I like seeing all the pieces. That's what was so surprising and beautiful about this. And the flavors hit your tongue a little differently.
So then what you would do is you could even break it up into shards and put it into a little gift box and you're home free.
That's all you have to do. And I actually go to my local pastry store and ask them if I can buy those little candy boxes if I don't have a nice tin or something around.
This sounds great. And I'm thinking, I buy those $6 a bar flavored chocolate bars with flavors like that, and I can make it now for a lot less money. Hey, thank you, dear, and happy holidays.
Thanks.
Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook. Now, her recipe for improvisational chocolates is easy to get. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, Holiday Musings with Grant Achatz, the James Beard Foundation Best Chef of 2008, and the new party cocktail. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. There's a restaurant in Chicago called Alinea that set up a buzz as soon as it opened. Its food was the attention getter. 20-something tiny courses of almost mystical machinations. Delicious, but intriguing, too. Poofs of scent from air-filled pillows. Fantastical designs, textures, and tastes. Yet this wasn't gimmick. It was fun, it was challenging, and it was very good. Well, last year, the James Beard Foundation named Alinea's creator, Chef Grant Achatz, the best chef in the United States. I was at that ceremony, and I was struck by Grant's acceptance speech. What everyone in the audience knew was that while Grant was creating Alinea's food, he was also on the upside of a fight against tongue cancer, and much of the time, he couldn't taste. Well, people have talked a lot about Grant's illness. I'm curious about his background and that amazing imagination. Grant's done a book about his food. It's called Alinea. And Grant Achatz, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Grant, tell me how you grew up.
Well, my mother and father owned a restaurant since I was 5 years old.
Oh, my.
Actually, my grandmother owned a restaurant and kind of branched out from there. A lot of my aunts and uncles, my mother and father. So it was very much a family thing growing up ever since I was a young boy.
So did you work in the restaurant?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 5 years old, washing dishes, you know. Of course, a five-year-old can't really reach the bottom of the pot sink, so they had to make me stand on milk crates so that I could actually reach the bottom of the bottom of the sink. But yeah, it was a great environment to grow up in, and you know, you learn the language and the atmosphere and the personality of the kitchen, and it really, I attribute that those early stages of development in cooking, even though the food is such a great departure from what I do now, mm-hmm. it was critical to my development.
Did you always want to be a chef?
As far as I can remember, yeah. I mean, there was at one point in high school where I kind of toyed with the idea of doing architectural design, but it lasted all of about 5 minutes, and then I realized mm-hmm. that I think my calling was to cook, to be a chef.
Yeah, but you know, you do some architectural design in your dishes, certainly.
Yeah, as it turns out, I kind of incorporate that element as well. Yeah.
What was Christmas like when you were a kid?
Well, of course, even though my mother and father owned a restaurant, cooking at home was still a big part of growing up. And my memories of childhood around the holiday time, it always conjures up the sweet kind of cookies and pies and things baking in the oven and being able to run in from outside playing in the snow and, you know, grabbing some hot chocolate and dunking a cookie in there or something like that.
Yeah.
You talk a lot in the book about the food at Alinea being designed that each dish evokes a different kind of emotion in the diner.
Right. And a large part of the inspiration for the dishes that we develop at Alinea are based off of that emotional connection that we have in our everyday lives. So, for instance, we did a dish at the restaurant last year around Christmas time that intentionally introduced the smell of what we called holiday goose. You know, traditionally a lot of times people, well, maybe not so much today in modern times, but historically a roasted goose for Christmas was very traditional. And with a roasted goose comes orange peel, nutmeg, and sage. Those are like the quintessential ingredients that are roasted with the bird.
Right.
So at the restaurant, we would do a more refined version where, of course, we wouldn't present the whole bird or give a large portion of meat, but it was a more refined, elegant presentation. But what was really important to us was to introduce the aroma of the bird roasting, the same fragrance that you would get walking into your grandmother's kitchen on Christmas Day when she pulls the oven door open and that wafting smell of goose fat and orange rind comes out. That's what we wanted the diners to experience while eating a highly refined composition at the restaurant.
So explain to me what you did.
It was pretty easy, actually. I mean, in this case, we used one of our techniques for introducing aroma that we just call simply heat activation, where we take a river stone about the size of a racquetball, slightly smaller, and heat it up in the oven, a 400-degree oven, until it's very hot. And then right before the food is served, we sprinkle over top of this hot stone freshly zested orange, some fresh sage leaves, and grated nutmeg. And in this case, we actually saved some of the rendered goose fat and put that over top as well. So now you have the aroma of a roasting goose with these aromatics. But then what was also interesting is because of the goose fat hitting the hot stone,
right,
it splattered and you know, kind of made the sound of a roasting goose
as
well. So it was, you were getting all the senses. You were getting smell. Obviously, you were getting the taste. You were even getting the audible component of it with the splattering fat. You know, we try to take people on a journey, tap into some memories, whether it be, you know, for me, it was, I grew up in Michigan, and one of the things that we used to do when it was a little bit more environmentally acceptable was rake the oak leaves out of our front yard out to the street. And as kids, we would jump in the pile a couple of times, and then ultimately you would light them on fire. And the smell of burning oak leaves to me is just a really powerful emotional trigger back to my childhood. So we introduced that aroma a couple of times at the restaurant to try to signify fall or autumn. And it works out really well. People actually, we've had a couple of people actually, you know, kind of break into tears because it reminded them of their childhood. It's a very powerful emotion. Smell is a very powerful emotional trigger.
It really is. It really is. Back to the holidays. What will you do this year with your kids for Christmas?
Well, we're closed from December 22nd right through until January 3rd this year. I kind of did something a little bit out of the box. Instead of working on the holidays, I actually wanted to spend them with my family and friends like everybody else. So it's going to be a really important holiday for me, being able to spend so much time with family and friends over that week and a half period. It's going to be pretty fantastic.
You're going to lose a lot of money. You're closing over probably the most profitable period that a restaurant has through the year.
Including New Year's Eve, which is, you know, traditionally,
wow,
you know, a big night for any restaurant. But, you know, it was, I'm young, I'm only 34, but at the same time, I've been working incredibly hard since I've been, you know, 17. Mm-hmm, you know, I went right from high school to culinary school, right out into the professional world, into an environment where 80, 90 hour weeks are the norm.
Yeah.
And have kind of sacrificed a great deal of that. The most important thing that we experience over the holidays, and that's family and friends. So now that, you know, I have the power or the ability to kind of make decisions based on whether or not I want to open my business or close my business, I said, you know, it's time to set some quality time aside. So that's what we did.
And you've also gone through a rough time with your health, too, over the past couple of years.
I think that's probably a large part of it as well. It really, you know, it makes you, when you're staring down, you know, a potentially terminal illness like that, it makes you think and it makes you appreciate life in a different way. Yeah. And, you know, that probably had a lot to do with it as well.
Grant, thanks for talking with us, and may it be a wonderful holiday for you and your family.
Thank you. You too.
Grant Achatz is chef owner of Alinea Restaurant in Chicago, and he's author of the book, Alinea. In the spirit of those childhood memories of homestyle holiday food, check out my menu for a simple Italian Christmas Eve supper. You can find recipes for antipasto salad of shrimp with curly endive and pasta with steamed mussels with tomato and capers. They're on the website, splendidtable.org.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
A lot of people overlook the easiest way to get a holiday party off and running. Greet your guests with a great cocktail. Now, I'm not talking overindulgence, but I'm talking sipping something delicious, surprising, maybe even playful. The cocktail is an all-American concept that hit the skids a while ago, but now it's back big time, and one of the people who led the renaissance is mixologist Dale DeGroff. Dale trains bar people around the world, and he's the author of The Essential Cocktail, The Art of Mixing Perfect Drinks. Dale, welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Lynn.
So when exactly was the golden age of the cocktail?
Well, the first serious book was 1862, and it was written by the father of our profession, Jerry Thomas. And in that book, he he did something that no one had done before. He wrote it down.
He wrote down recipes of cocktails.
Right. There were practical guides for housewives in the 18th century and the 19th century, but there was nothing that actually listed cocktails, sangries, punches, fizzes, slings, the way he did, and codified everything in that book. And that started it, really. By the 1880s, lots of things had fallen into place, and I would say between 1880 and 1900 was really when the sour, the fizz, the julep, the martini, the Manhattan, all these things were either invented or perfected.
That's amazing because, you know, I would place it, well, I guess that most of us think of it as being during Prohibition, during the Roaring Twenties.
But that's a fallacy, yeah.
Yeah. So cocktails now are what? Fresh ingredients, new ideas.
Sure. It's a revolution that started on the culinary side of our business. And this whole thing of the American chef and the fusion cuisine and the extraordinary choices we have on the dining side is something relatively new. And I think that love affair with big flavor that the American people have or what finally in the final analysis drove this whole cocktail thing, because after being offered such incredible choices on the dining side and then to walk up to a bar and have a guy push a button on a gun to make you a whiskey sour. I mean, no.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, it's the holidays. Drinks that really make sense for entertaining. You know, I'm thinking I'm not going to stand there and mix a drink for my guests because I just can't. So some ideas for us of things that, you know, maybe they're not going to interfere with the food or they're easy to do ahead.
Sure, sure. Well, there are some sparkling wines that are, you know, this is time when everybody's thinking about value, obviously.
Right.
And we don't have to go to the high end. We can go to sparkling wines. Well, first of all, domestic sparkling wines, which are less expensive than, mm-hmm. than the French variety. We can go to Italian sparklings from northern Italy, which are the Prosecco, the drier style. I'm not talking about the Asti now. The drier style
right.
Proseccos from the northern Italy, and use those as a basis for some really delightful, punchy kind of fresh herb and fruit drinks. I have a couple in my new book. One is called Pero Frizzante, where you actually take a whole pear and slice it up into wedges mm-hmm. and put it in the bottom of a pitcher and muddle it. You could use a wooden spoon, but I would prefer that you go out and buy yourself online a good bar muddler, M-U-D-D-L-E-R, and you use it to mash flavors, herbs, fruits. And this is the sort of new wave in cocktail making now, is getting fresh ingredients into the drink. And one way to do it is to simply to macerate it. Let's say you want to make a pitcher of this Pero Frizzante. Get yourself a couple of good Anjou pears and cut them into wedges, nice and ripe. Put them in the bottom of a big pitcher. Get your muddler out. And along with it, throw in about maybe 9 sage leaves. I know that sounds crazy, but as I said, we're borrowing from the kitchen. Oh, yeah. And then get some prunes that you've already stewed and got mm-hmm. them a little bit soft.
Right.
And throw them down. Their purple plums are perfect. You know, throw them down there in the bottom, pitted, of course. Maybe a couple of tablespoons of honey.
Mm-hmm.
And mash it all together, and then take a bottle of Prosecco, and best thing to have would be one of those great pitchers that's wider at the top than it is at the bottom, because then you can just slowly pour the Prosecco down the side of that pitcher so to retain all the frizzante.
Right.
And then drag those ingredients up through the wine as it comes down until you've got a good mix, and serve it by the pitcher through a strainer into either another pitcher or directly into the glass. But it's a really delightful, light, food-friendly kind of drink to have at holiday time.
I am thirsty already. Dale,
yes,
thank you.
My pleasure.
Dale DeGroff is author of The Essential Cocktail, The Art of Mixing Perfect Drinks. Now, for his Pero Frizzante cocktail recipe, go to the website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open. We're taking your calls today, brought to you by Palm Wonderful. 100% authentic pomegranate juice at palmwonderful.com. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Britt is on the line from Babcock, Wisconsin. So, Britt, what is happening?
Well, I'll tell you the story. My husband and I live on our cranberry marsh here in central Wisconsin.
You grow cranberries?
Yes, we do. My husband's a fifth-generation cranberry farmer.
Huh.
Yeah, so we have some friends down the road who raise, among other things, heritage turkeys.
So this sounds like the ideal marriage.
It really it is. So we traded some cranberries this year for one of their lovely bourbon red turkeys.
Huh.
And I'd really like to do justice to this turkey. So do you have any suggestions for how I can enhance the best attributes of this bourbon red?
Of course, because, of course, I want to ask you all about what is it like to farm cranberries. But, okay, we'll hold off. We'll hold off on that. We'll hold
off. That's another show.
Yeah, that's another show. You're right. All right. With a heritage bird, what you've got is generally meat that's leaner. It's going to be delicious.
Okay, good.
It's going to really be there, generally much fuller flavored. I always think of the idea that it's almost as though the whole turkey is dark meat. And I don't mean it's all dark. It's just that it has real taste.
Well, dark meat's the best. So that
yeah.
sounds good.
Yeah, I feel the same way. But anyway, low and slow. You want 300, 325. And I would say that the trick is, are you going to stuff it, you think?
I think so.
Okay. If you stuff it, you figure usually about 15 to 18 minutes to the pound.
Okay.
And what you want to do, I like to use a relatively shallow pan, something about 2 inches deep.
Okay.
And you can use a rack if you want to, or you can make a rack out of sprinkling some of those cranberries. But seriously, you know, they're tart and acidic, and you could have sliced onions and you could have cranberries.
Oh, wonderful.
Wouldn't that be fabulous? And whole, you know, cloves of garlic, just skin them. Uh-huh. And you could put a little bit of carrot in there, and that could be your rack.
Okay, wonderful.
Wouldn't that be fabulous?
Yeah.
And then what you want to do is baste it. I'm a baster. There are two ways of cooking a turkey. There are people who say you put it in the oven and you time it, and you test it for doneness. Mm-hmm. Forget, you know, and maybe pour something over it that you like. Mm-hmm. There are the people like me who say every half hour or so you baste it with its own juices. You give it back to itself.
Okay, that sounds wonderful.
Which, by the way, slows down the cooking because every time you open the oven, the temperature goes down.
Oh, okay.
But figure 15, 18 minutes to the pound.
Okay.
And then what you're going to do is you'll take the thickest part of the bird, so the thigh or the breast, mm-hmm. and toward the end of your time, you'll start sticking an instant reading thermometer to the center of that meat, and you want it at about 165
degrees. 165
degrees. Right.
Okay.
And when you work out timing, add 45 minutes to it.
Okay.
That's your pad if you need to go longer. But also, that bird can wait anywhere. People say up to 30 minutes. I have let it go much longer. I've let it go to 45 or even an hour.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it settles. All the juices settle, it gets tender, it gets juicy, and it will be delicious.
Okay.
Absolutely delicious.
Wonderful.
Okay, so are you going to season it with cranberries in any way?
Well, probably. We've got enough around.
you're literally swimming in them, aren't you? Well, I would say throw some cranberries in the pan. I think it'll be fabulous.
Okay, and it'll look good, too.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to love that bird. You're going to love that bird.
Good.
You take care, Britt.
Okay, you too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. 'Tis the season for serving port, but how can port bring bad luck in the new year? Well, we're going to be back in a moment with that answer and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we'll be going back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how can port wine bring bad luck in the new year? Well, apparently, it is all in how you pass the port around the table. Apparently, you have to pass it to the right. If you pass the port to the left, it's going to bring bad luck to everybody sitting there. Now, this means if you refuse a glass of port and then you change your mind, it has to go all the way around the table before coming to you again, and whoever wishes to take a dram before you get it back need only ask. You have to say yes. Now, nothing is easier than port for dessert. All you need is the port wine, some dried fruits, unshelled nuts, and some kind of blue cheese. And by the way, a corkscrew. Okay, let's get back to the phones. Call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who has been waiting patiently? We have got Dan calling from Knoxville, Iowa. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
Well, I've got a little bit of a problem, Lynn. I am actually the police chief here in Knoxville.
That's a problem?
Well, it is, because I have this arrangement with my officers and employees.
Uh-huh.
Anytime my picture's in the paper, I have to provide them with food.
You know, you're the only person I can think of that may want to hire a PR agent to keep you out of the paper.
Well, it has caused problems in the past when I've been doing presentations and the reporters will show up and I'll find out later my staff called them just because they were hungry.
Okay. You sound like you've got great people working with
you. We have a great department. It's a fun place to work. But my problem is a lot of times I'll just buy pizza because it's quick and easy, but right. I also like to cook. So I do bring them homemade food, and I have about three meals that they really enjoy, and one of them being lasagna,
right?
Which is great because it reheats great.
Right, exactly.
Chili is the other big one.
And that reheats great,
and
right?
It stays up. And yeah. Their all-time favorite is I do a chicken with saffron-infused noodles.
Wow, that sounds great.
It is, and then because I use the saffron, it turns everything bright yellow, and it's a great visual presentation, too.
Oh, that sounds great.
But that's my problem is I'm limited to about three dishes. What I'm looking for is some other things I could offer my people. And the idea is they either have to be able to sit all day in a crock pot
right.
or something that can be reheated in a microwave real quick and easy.
Yeah. Well, I got a couple of thoughts for you.
Okay.
Speaking of PR, it's just a little plug for this book we did. But there is a recipe in our book, and it's really easy. It's a Philippine-style chicken adobo. You take about 3 pounds of boned-out chicken thighs. Okay, which are fairly cheap, too,
right.
Which I love. And, you know, you can cook – a chicken thigh never dies.
Okay.
Not that you should cook it to shreds, but the idea is it can wait. So you marinate it overnight in a combination of vinegar, soy sauce, a ton of garlic. So let's say you got a quarter of a cup of soy sauce, a cup of vinegar, probably 10 crushed cloves of garlic, a teaspoon or two of fresh ground black pepper. Okay, and maybe a cup of tomatoes and a bit of olive oil. You could do a couple of tablespoons of olive oil. And you marinate that overnight, and then you take that mixture and you put it in a saucepan and you add enough water to barely cover the chicken and you simmer it really, really, really gently until the thighs are tender. And it's usually about 20, 25 minutes.
Fair enough.
Okay, now here's the trick and here's the fun part. You take the thighs out. Now, you can do this all the night ahead. You can do this over 2 days.
Okay.
All right? You take the thighs out, and you take the juices, skim as much fat as you can off of those juices, and you boil them down until they're thick and so intensely flavored, you think you have died and gone to heaven. Okay?
Okay.
And now, in a skillet, you brown up a sliced onion with some salt and pepper. And you brown the thighs, the cooked thighs.
Oh.
And if ideally they can be bone out, but you want skin on.
Right.
If you can.
You gotta have that texture.
Yeah, right. And if you want to leave the bone in, the heck with it. I mean, either way, it's going to work. And the idea is it's such a curious thing. It's a big tradition in the Philippines. You can do this with pork and chicken. It's done with fish. That instead of browning first the way you normally do with a stew, you brown at the end. You put the whole thing back together. Now, you could have that in a crock pot.
Right.
Sitting there waiting. Everybody just scoops out what they want. And then what you could do is you could make some yellow rice. And if you don't want to blow the money on saffron, okay, you could cook your rice. And I cook my rice like pasta.
Right.
You know, big pot of boiling water, drop in the rice, throw some turmeric in, and you'll have yellow rice. And it looks fabulous.
Oh, it sounds like a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And if you want to throw some carrots or potatoes into that mix, you know, into that chicken dish, they are great because it's this vinegar and the garlic. It just tastes wonderful. And any spice comes from that delicious black pepper in there.
Okay.
So you think that'll help?
I think it'll give me one more dish to try.
You're really nice to your people.
You have to be nice. Well, one of the things I point out is the reason I get my picture in the paper isn't usually because of something I did. It's something they did.
So what do they do when they get their pictures in the paper?
Well, one or two of them will actually buy the pizza, too. But most of them just remind me that they're underpaid and that they can't afford to.
Hey, Dan, thanks for calling.
It's my pleasure.
Whole new insight into law enforcement.
We're a little different.
You take care.
Thank you much.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Who knew? I mean, probably the best place to eat, maybe? The police station. I love it. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Lynn on the line from Moorhead, Minnesota. Lynn, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I need your creative advice on using a very tiny baking dish.
How creative and how tiny?
Well, these little dishes are about 2 inches across and only about an inch deep. And I got them at a garage sale, a whole bag of them for about 50 cents.
My favorite,
just couldn't resist them.
I wouldn't be able to either. And I must say, this kind of thing, garage sales and all that, are my favorite source of equipment and all kinds of good things. So they're about, what did you say, 2 inches in diameter and about an inch deep.
And they are microwave and oven safe.
Right.
And what I want to do is make something really special. One or two bite treat to give to my coworkers, but I can't think of anything more creative than a brownie, and that's pretty dull.
Oh, we can do something really super duper easy for them, and you won't even have to bake it. Two things that come to mind, my standard, because it's so easy, is panna cotta. And my panna cotta recipe, if I do say so myself, is so lush and so rich that that particular amount is probably just enough. Or you could do what's called a chocolate ganache. Now listen to what this is. This is hot cream mixed with melted chocolate and whatever flavorings you like. And you would pour it into those little cups and just chill it.
Ooh, and okay. It
is dense and thick. So I'll tell you about the panna cotta and I'll tell you about the ganache. The panna cotta is 3 cups of cream, 1 cup of sour cream, 1/2 cup of sugar, pinch of salt, and whatever flavoring you like. I like vanilla, but you can do anything with it. Oh, and 1/2 teaspoon to 1 teaspoon of plain gelatin. So what you do is you put the plain gelatin in a small container. You put a couple of tablespoons of cold water over it, and it's going to sort of blossom. You know, it's going to – if you've ever worked with gelatin, you know how it just sucks up that water, and all of a sudden it looks like a baby sponge. So you set that aside. Put the 3 cups of cream in a saucepan. Put the 1 cup of sour cream in a large bowl. Throw vanilla, 1 or 2 teaspoons of vanilla, into the cream in the saucepan. 1/2 cup of sugar in there and a pinch of salt. Heat it up. It doesn't have to be bubbling, but it has to be pretty hot. And then whisk in that gelatin until everything is smooth. In so many words, the gelatin's completely melted.
Okay.
Let that cool for about 5 minutes, and then with a whisk, slowly beat it into the sour cream. And you're done. You just pour it into your little ramekins and chill them. Keep it covered in the fridge, just with saran wrap or whatever, just because it tends to absorb the flavors in the refrigerator. And one time I had a fish that was pretty fresh, and I had it open to the air on ice, and we had sea bass flavored panna cotta for dessert.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that doesn't sound good.
Doesn't sound good. Now, you could add chocolate to that. You could add grated orange, lemon, anything you like. To do the ganache, which is even richer than that, you would take 2 cups of cream, and then you want to have about 1/2 pound of bittersweet chocolate. And you melt the chocolate separately. You gently warm the cream. Don't let it boil. You just want to get it warm. And you gently whisk in the chocolate, very moderate heat, until it's completely smooth. Now, you can add cinnamon to that, vanilla, chili. You could make it into like a Mexican ganache with the traditional Mexican hot chocolate ingredients of chili, vanilla, ground almonds, and cinnamon. Or you could add, again, a little bit of orange, any flavoring you like, or just plain vanilla. I like to add a little espresso coffee, too. And when you pour that into your little ramekins and you chill it, it's going to get really firm. It's going to be like the inside of a really great chocolate candy.
Wow.
And it's fabulous. And the more chocolate you have in proportion to cream, the stiffer it gets.
Okay.
Those little ramekins are going to really come in handy.
And no one will be able to complain that I'm filling them up with too many calories
exactly.
for the holidays.
You're going to use those a lot.
Well, that sounds great. Thank
All right,
you so
enjoy.
Much for your ideas.
You are welcome, and thanks for calling.
All right. Have a great holiday.
You too. You
Bye.
Too. Take care, Lynn. Want to wow a crowd? Have guests marveling at your culinary daring do? Serve them a creation done with puff pastry. Ah, you have not met up with puff pastry. Well, there's a book that tells all. It's by the food editor of Portland's Oregonian newspaper, Martha Holmberg, and the book is Puff, 50 Flaky, Crunchy, Delicious Appetizers, Entrees, and Desserts Made with Puff Pastry. Martha, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So why don't you explain what is puff pastry?
Well, the first thing I want to explain is all those 50 things you can make with puff pastry from the freezer case.
This is brilliant. This is brilliant.
That's why this is such a wonderful ingredient, because it does give you that amazing, impressive, flaky, cool result. But if you don't want to make your own, the stuff that you can buy in the freezer case is brilliant. And in fact, in a lot of cases, it's better than making your own.
So maybe just explain exactly what puff pastry is. Why do we need to get it frozen? Because it's tricky to make.
Yeah, puff pastry in French, we call it pâte feuilletée. And it's one of those classic French pastries that is made by making a dough, layering this giant hunk of butter, rolling it out, folding it, twisting, turning, la, la, la. You go through a process, which is actually fun to do. Mm-hmm. But it takes several stages and several steps, and what you end up with is this layers, I never know the exact number, like 1,200 and something,
yeah,
tiny layers of dough and then butter, and dough and butter and dough butter. So when it bakes, the butter melts, the steam raises up the dough, and you get a very layered, delicate, fragile, beautiful pastry. But it is, you know, it takes a little bit of time to master. When I was in cooking school, I had the kind of time and mentality to make my own, and it's highly satisfying. But now that I have a life, I like to go to the freezer department.
All right. So now, what if we're going to buy it in the store, what should we be looking for? Are there several different brands?
The brand that you'll find in just about every store, I mean, I joke and say you can buy it like in the 7-Eleven practically, is mm-hmm. Pepperidge Farm. Good old Pepperidge Farm. And it comes in a pack with two sheets of pastry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good. I call it bulletproof. You can mess with it. You can put it in the fridge, take it out, whatever. It'll always perform. The one drawback is that it's not all butter, so the flavor isn't the most delicious. There's another brand called Dufour, like from the oven, which mm-hmm. is all butter, and that's more in a specialty store, gourmet store. And I think some of the Trader Joe's now have an all butter version.
Can you give us the highlights of what we have to know in terms of, we've got these frozen sheets of pastry. They're sort of like almost a long, narrow book. What do we need to know about handling them? What are the keys?
Well, the real key is to not try to work with it until it's fully thawed. And the best thing to do is let it thaw in the fridge. But you can let it thaw on the countertop 30, 40 minutes. And then it's very floppy and easy to use and easy to roll out.
So give us some ideas of what you can do with this stuff.
Well, first of all, there's all the classics. Cheese straws, you know, you've got to have a cheese straw. Those little twists of puff pastry.
Oh, yeah, where you take a long strip and you just keep twisting it.
Yeah, and they're perfect for cocktails. But the simplest thing is you roll out your dough, fold up the edges, pile on some apples or peaches or, you know, something savory like a pizza, and just bake it. That's delicious.
So it's like a free-form tart.
Yes. So there's that kind of what I think of as sort of French-inspired dishes in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had so much fun with ethnic dishes, like one of my favorite recipes is a samosa with a potato and pea and ginger and curry spice filling. Just cut a square, fold it over into a triangle with this filling in it, and it's so easy. I have a little cilantro chili dip in
there.
Well,
that sounds wonderful.
And then there's deep-fried puff pastry. I thought, what would happen if we fried some? So I just took a little piece of the dough,
mm-hmm.
dropped it in a pan of hot fat. Oh, my God, it puffs up. It's light. It is so not greasy. I've done profiteroles that way. I've done churros, you know, the sort of Mexican.
Oh, like the long donut.
Yeah, long donut.
Yeah, with the cinnamon and the sugar, at least lots of sugar, yeah.
So it was kind of a revelation to me, and it's really easy, really fun, and it takes you beyond what you might already know from puff pastry.
I love it. Hey, Martha, thank you.
Thank you.
Martha Holmberg is author of Puff. Now, you can find her recipe for ham gruyere and Dijon pommiers on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And from all of us here at the Splendid Table to you and yours, may this be an especially warm and close holiday season. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Kin Hubbard, who said, "Nothing is as mean as giving a little child something useful for Christmas." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, information on nearly everything that you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find priceless newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. I think that title says it all. Anyway, check it all out, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is supported in part by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice backed by $25 million in medical research. You can learn more about the antioxidant superpower at palmwonderful.com. Palm Wonderful, trust in Palm. And by gather.com, the social network with substance where people connect around their interests. You can join the conversation on cooking at gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. May you and all the people you care about have a great holiday season. And please join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.